Well, good afternoon, listeners. Here we are with the Dogs Program once again. 12 o'clock every Saturday, we're here to defend and to promote public education. And that, of course, is not private education or religious education. We believe also in the separation of church and state. Unfortunately, up there in New South Wales, the Anglican Church, as well as the Catholic Church, and all the others, all the Calathumpians from around the place, have got in onto the gravy train of state aid. Very independent they are, aren't they? Certainly not of our taxes. And there has been a 30% rise in their enrolments in the last decade, thanks to the policies of both the Liberal and the Labor Party, who aren't prepared to take them on. Let's hear about it from Andy.
Thanks, Jean. New South Wales religious schools see 30% rise in enrolments in a decade, and not necessarily due to beliefs. The face of independent schools is changing, led by more affordable Christian, Islamic and Anglican schools. And this was published in The Guardian and written by Caitlin Cassidy. When the Australian Christian College, ACC, in northwest Sydney began receiving a surge of enrolments after the pandemic lockdowns, its principal, Brendan Corr, was not surprised. ACC is located in Marsden Park, a major growth corridor of Sydney identified by the state government as an area where a failure to factor in the pace and scale of development has left families without access to local public schools. ACC has more than doubled in size from 667 students in 2019 to 2,155 in 2024, the strongest growth of any independent school in New South Wales. While 60% of families are Christian, 40% either have no religion or from other faith backgrounds, predominantly Hindu. The ACC is not an outlier. Enrolments in religious schools have increased by a record 30% in New South Wales in the past decade, new data shows, and not necessarily correlating with student beliefs. The Association of Independent Schools of New South Wales, AISNSW, the peak body for the state's 430 independent schools, released a new report on Wednesday finding independent schools have enrolled almost two-thirds of the state's additional students since 2000, growing by 101,565. More new students were enrolled in New South Wales independent schools in the past 5 years than every state and territory government school sector combined. They now account for almost 20% of state enrolments, up from 13% in 2000. And religious independent schools, which represent more than 80% of the sector, have done the heavy lifting. Enrolments surged by 30% in a decade, compared with 2% in government schools and 6% in Catholic systemic systems. Growth was highest in Sydney's northwest and southwest, including Blacktown, Baulkham Hills and Hawkesbury, where 10 new low to medium fee independent schools opened over the past decade. The Acting Education Minister, Courtney Hussos, says the former government neglected growing suburbs, leaving many families in Western Sydney without a public school option. An audit of enrolment growth in New South Wales released last year found the top 10 student growth areas between 2018 and 2023, all located in Sydney's northwest and southwest corridors, collectively accounted for almost 40% of the state's student enrolment growth. Hussos says the state government is investing $9 billion in new and upgrading schools, including $3.9 billion in Western Sydney to address the backlog, including new schools in Leppington, Tallawong, Box Hill, Gables, Gledswood Hills and Jordan Springs. Corr believes his school success is not just down to geography. Spiritual nurturing is something that's important to our parents, he says. It's not even just that people of non-faith are welcomed into the school, which they undoubtedly are. Regardless of the faith position of a family, the students gain benefit of being part of our Christian community because of the way we see humanity and serve it. AISNSW's Chief Executive Marjorie Evans says the face of independent schools is changing, led by low to medium fee Christian, Islamic and Anglican schools. In 2025, the typical independent school is co-ed, K-12, faith-based, located west of Parramatta, and charging less than $6,000 a year, Evans says. That's despite a decline in religious affiliation. The percentage of students who identified as having no faith in New South Wales almost doubled in the past decade, the report found, from 16% to 29%. But while affiliation with Christianity dropped from 55% to 38%, students identifying as Islamic increased from 8% to 12%. The findings aligned with the latest census data, which found religious affiliation had dramatically reduced overall, but non-Christian religions, including Islam, Hinduism, Sikhism and Buddhism, grew from 3.5% of the population in 1996 to 10% in 2021, or 2.5 million people. Anglican schools enrolled the largest proportion of students in New South Wales independent schools, 27%, followed by Catholic independent, 18%, and Christian, 16%, the AIS-NSW report found. They were among 15 different faiths represented in the state's schooling system, from Hare Krishna to Seventh-day Adventist, Pentecostal, and Brethren. Islamic schools experienced the most rapid annual enrolment growth of any sector in the past 5 years, 5.2%, or an additional 5,074 students, representing 9% of the state's religious schools overall. Four expanded by more than 20% in the past 5 years, placing them among the top 15 fastest growing schools statewide. The religious schools sector has faced backlash in recent years for allowing staff and students to be discriminated against on the basis of sexuality and gender identity. Last year, the Australian Law Reform Commission recommended the blanket exemptions should be repealed, a view backed by the majority of Australians. But the Prime Minister has ruled out legislating new laws without bipartisan support. Emma Rowe, an associate professor in education at Deakin University, says religious schools can be very inclusive towards different identities, but she is against private schools, disproportionately composed of religious schools, receiving taxpayer money. I'm not opposed to religious schools receiving government funding. I'm opposed to private schools receiving government funding, Rowe says. If you want to practice a religion in school, but you're not charging tuition fees and you're accepting everyone at the door, I think that's different. And yes, it is. Back to you, Jean.
Well, thanks, Sandy. And meanwhile, of course, as our home affairs minister, Mr. Burke, says, oh, no, we mustn't have extremists, we mustn't have religious problems here in Australia, so we must keep them out. We're producing them, of course, in our religious schools, our sectarian schools. And up there in the Northern Territories, the private schools are very happy with what's now happening to the anti-discrimination bill. Religious schools are allowed to discriminate on the basis of religion. Let's hear about it.
Thanks, Jean. Christian schools welcome Northern Territory anti-discrimination bill. This is an article from 31st of July in the Territory News. Northern Territory Attorney General Marie-Claire Boothby yesterday introduced the Anti-Discrimination Amendment Bill to Parliament, reinstating an exception for religious schools to hire on the basis of faith and removing the word offence from vilification protections. The Northern Territory Anti-Discrimination Watchdog has expressed concern over the proposed legislation, warning the reforms undermine the very purpose of the protections. The proposed rewording means discriminatory conduct would have to incite hatred, serious contempt, or severe ridicule to be considered hate speech. Ms. Boothby said the changes aimed to strike the balance between safeguarding freedom of speech, religion, and belief, and protecting Territorians from harm. We want Territorians to feel safe and also free to speak their mind without fear. It comes 3 years after the previous Labor government overhauled the Anti-Discrimination Act, which the Country Liberal Party said blurred the line between unlawful discrimination and everyday conversation. The amendments also allowed schools to discriminate when hiring, including for non-faith-based roles such as math teachers, cleaners or admin staff. Ms. Boothby confirmed there had been no complaints from Territory schools in relation to the current hiring laws, but reforms allowed for schools to be really confident in choosing teachers based on faith. The Australian Association of Christian Schools Chief Executive Vanessa Cheng welcomed the reforms, as the Territory is the only place in Australia with no legal protections for religious schools to employ people of the same faith. We applaud the CLP government for taking this important step to fulfil their election commitment and restore fundamental human freedoms, she said. In contrast, the Independent Education Union said the changes did not reflect modern community values, and it was evident religious schools had the capacity and resilience to continue to operate in the absence of discrimination exemptions. And I think that is absolutely true. If you want to discriminate against people on the basis of their gender or sexual identity, that is an affront to the human spirit, in my opinion. Back to you, Jean.
Well, there you are, and the most powerful lobby group in Australia. But don't worry, there are others. There are those in the public system that know what the public system's about, where we try to bring the children together to prevent sectarian trouble in the future. And the teachers up there in the Northern Territory have their own views on this matter. Let's hear Andy again.
Thanks, Jean. Religious exemptions are necessary and harmful, say Northern Territory teachers. And this is an article from Q News and published on the 31st of July, written by Dean Arcuri. The Northern Territory Union representing teachers say that the reinstatement of religious discrimination exemptions is unnecessary, divisive, and harmful. Northern Territory Attorney General Marie-Claire Boothby introduced an anti-discrimination amendment bill to Parliament yesterday. The bill reinstates an exception for religious schools to hire based on faith and removes the word offence from vilification protections. In 2023, the Northern Territory's Anti-Discrimination Act was brought in line with community expectations. With the introduction of this bill, the country Liberal Party government is attempting to repeal vital protections against hate speech, Equality Australia say. Reinstating an exemption that permits discrimination in religious education. The Independent Education Union, Queensland and Northern Territory, IEUQNT, represent teachers and support staff in Northern Territory non-government schools. They say the reinstatement of religious discrimination exemptions is unnecessary, divisive and harmful. As faith-based schools have been more than capable of functioning in the absence of these exemptions. Indeed, they have done so quite adequately under the legislation which has been in place for the last 3 years, IEUQNT Branch Secretary Terry Burke said. Reinstatement of religious discrimination exemptions in the NT does not reflect modern community values and expectations, especially given that many faith-based organisations receive public funds. Employers still have the opportunity at the point of engagement to determine if an employee is suitable for the position advertised. That has always been the case. Back to you, Jean.
Many thanks, Andy, but let's now have a short break.
Looking for an easy way to keep up with your annual 3CR subscription? You can now set up an annual debit from your bank account or credit card. And once a year, your payment will be automatically deducted. You can cancel at any time and you'll get a reminder each year before payment. Be a constant supporter of Melbourne's precious independent community radio station and set up a recurring payment today. Just go to 3cr.org.au/subscribe.
Hope that you're still listening to the Dogs program. And you wouldn't be surprised to hear, of course, that one of the most difficult jobs in Australia at the moment is being a teacher and certainly being a principal. And there is an interesting online magazine, I suppose you might call it, called The Educator, which had a very interesting article this week about how principals are pushing for urgent reforms to save a lot of the problems in their schools. Over to Sorrel.
Thanks, Jean. This article was written by Brett Hanaberry and is entitled Principals Push for Urgent Reforms to Save Schools. Whether it's managing complex student behaviour, supporting diverse academic pathways, or fostering a strong culture of well-being and professional development for staff, high school principals are faced with a myriad of challenges. In recent years, increasingly disruptive classrooms, declining student achievement, growing disadvantage, and persistent teacher shortages have only added to the complexity of the job. While the Better, Fairer Schools Funding Agreement is, for now, the best hope that federal, state, and territory governments have of tackling these issues at a national scale, turning these policy shifts into real-world improvements for staff, students, and communities has become the defining test of school leadership in 2025. Through its national advocacy, research, and collaboration, the Australian Secondary Principals Association, ASPA, has been helping to shape education policy and practice to reflect the realities and aspirations of secondary school communities across Australia. since federal, state, and territory governments began convening for the Education Ministers' Meeting, the EMM, in 2020, ASPA has been among those making sure that each year the goal of achieving a high-quality public education system accessible to all remains top of the EMM agenda. According to ASPA President Andy Meeson, a strong, well-supported leadership lies at the cornerstone of this noble aspiration. Currently, secondary school leaders face a complex and evolving landscape of challenges that impact their ability to lead effectively and hinder their students' learning experiences, Meeson told The Educator. These challenges require urgent attention and collaborative solutions to ensure a thriving future for public education in Australia. Meeson said a recurring theme in ASPA's consultations is the pervasive inequity within the Australian education system. While the Better and Fairer Schools funding agreement holds the promise of full funding, the reality is that public schools will continue to face significant resource constraints for several years before this funding fully materialises, he said. This delay exacerbates existing disparities between public and private schools, reducing the ability of public schools to provide equitable opportunities for all students. Meeson also pointed to research from Professor Michelle Bruninger's through UTS and the Paul Ramsey Foundation, which highlights the increasing segregation within Australia's school system. This segregation, driven by funding inconsistencies and regulatory disparities between sectors, demands a national conversation and concerted action to create a more equitable and inclusive education landscape, he said. There should be a common funding and regulatory framework for all schools that receive public money in Australia. There are excellent examples of this already, such as those in Ontario and Alberta in Canada. Meeson said ASPA welcomes the five enabling initiatives within the Better Fairer Schools funding agreement, particularly the commitment to better understand and provide advice to education ministers on socioeconomic diversity. We look forward to engaging with this work and advocating for policies that address the root causes of school segregation. The latest national survey into the occupational health, safety and well-being of Australia's principals found more than half intend to quit. Meeson says secondary school leaders are increasingly burdened by administrative demands that detract from their core purpose, leading teaching and learning. Excessive compliance requirements, risk management activities, and bureaucratic processes consume valuable time and resources that could be better directed towards supporting teachers and improving student outcomes, he said. ASPA would like to see more efficient school business and administrative systems and processes, provision of adequate support staff, and better strategies to empower principals to focus on instructional leadership. Meeson said the well-being of school leaders remains a critical concern, with principals facing significant pressure, long hours, and a lack of adequate support leading to burnout and stress. ASPA would like to see a nationally consistent framework to support principal well-being, including access to professional counselling, peer support networks, and mental health initiatives specifically tailored to the needs of school leaders, he said. Meeson said there is also an opportunity for the Australian Teacher Workforce Data Survey, the ATWD, to provide a more detailed picture of the conditions for teachers and school leaders. We look forward to what the newly added wellbeing module reveals later in the year, and then to working with governments and other agencies on how best to respond. ASPA is calling for a stronger partnership between the Australian Education Research Organisation, AERO, and the education profession, warning of a one-size-fits-all solution being imposed from afar. ASPA recognises the importance of evidence-informed practice in education, However, we are concerned about the narrow definition of evidence often promoted by organisations like Aero, Meeson said. While quantitative studies have their place, a broader, more holistic approach is needed that values the professional expertise of teachers and school leaders. Meeson said ASPA advocates for a partnership approach with Aero that recognises the complex, dynamic nature of teaching and learning and incorporates the lived experience of educators in research and policy development. The top-down model feels disconnected from the dynamic and diverse context of our schools, where a one-size-fits-all solution rarely fits anyone perfectly, he said. A healthier move would be to build a shared understanding of the complex ingredients of great teaching and learning, rather than simply searching for recipes. In May, research from the Queensland University of Technology found that unrealistic classroom readiness expectations on new teachers are fueling burnout and causing some to leave the profession, exacerbating existing workforce shortages in schools. Meeson said the national teacher shortage remains a significant challenge for secondary schools, particularly in remote, regional and outer metropolitan areas. Attracting and retaining high-quality teachers is essential for ensuring student success, he said. Although there has been an increase in people commencing teaching degrees, which is positive, we hope that revisiting the National Teacher Workforce Plan this year will be a ministerial priority and that more attention will be given to sustaining and retaining the teachers and school leaders we already have. Associate Professor Narita Spina, co-author of the QUT study, flagged an urgent need to ensure new teachers are well prepared in their initial teacher education degrees and then well supported once they started work into their profession. A teacher's journey should be one of continuous development, shaped by meaningful mentorship and accessible opportunities for learning. Without these, new educators may struggle to navigate the complexities of real-world teaching, she said. Standardized testing alone does not prepare teachers for the reality of the classroom. Instead, we must invest in hands-on training, professional collaboration, and real-world teaching experiences that truly equip them for success. In June, the eSafety Commissioner issued a safety advisory describing the rise of AI-powered deepfake abuse disrupting students, families, and school communities. The advisory outlined how such content emerges, impacts victims, and what schools, parents, and students can do to respond and report these issues. In response to the increasingly complex threat the misuse of these technologies poses to young people, federal and state education ministers endorsed the 2024 review of Australia's framework for generative AI in schools. However, Meeson said the dangerous applications of AI and cyberbullying is not an issue that should be left to schools to manage. We have made submissions to the federal government's rapid anti-bullying review, and we hope to see some sensible recommendations that will strengthen the support and resources available to the parents and school leaders, he said. This will also require greater accountability for the tech companies that deliver these platforms and apps. In the wake of the abuse revelations surrounding the Victorian childcare system, Meeson said communities should be reminded of the recommendations of the 2017 Royal Commission into Institutional Sexual Abuse, which called for greater coordination between states and territories, which have still not been implemented. Despite repeated calls for action, complaints to the regulator, the Quality Assessment and Regulation Division, QARD, have increased by 45% since 2018, while enforcement actions have dropped by 67%. These issues are also relevant to the school education sector, and we would like to see a nationally unified teacher registration system, as recommended in AITSL's 2018 National Review of Teacher Registration, Meeson said. The well-being and engagement of students are paramount. Meeson said students thrive in supportive environments where they feel safe, connected, and empowered. ASPA has been working for policies and practices that prioritise student well-being and agency, and that support expanded approaches to measuring and celebrating the many ways students demonstrate their knowledge and skill beyond narrow metrics such as the ATAR, he said. Meeson said ASPA remains committed to working collaboratively with governments, policymakers, and the wider community to address these critical challenges and create a thriving public education system that serves all students. We believe that by investing in school leadership, promoting equity, and valuing the expertise of educators, we can build a brighter future for Australian education. Back over to you, Jean.
Yes, well, we're in an interesting age, aren't we? And we're talking a lot about AI. There's a lot of hype about it and a lot of comradeship with it. It's actually automation. And the question is, how clever is automation? Can AI audits of the scholarly record, are they any use? Just how useful is AI going to be? And how dangerous is it going to be? Let's hear from Dale.
Thanks, Jean. This is an article by Naomi Oreskes titled, When AI Audits the Scholarly Record, What Will Happen to Public Trust in Science? Self-correction is fundamental to science. One of its most important forms is peer review, when anonymous experts scrutinise research before it is published. This helps safeguard the accuracy of the written record. Yet problems slip through. A range of grassroots and institutional initiatives work to identify problematic papers, strengthen the peer review process, and clean up the scientific record through retractions or journal closures. But these efforts are imperfect and resource intensive. Soon, artificial intelligence, AI, will be able to supercharge these efforts. What might that mean for public trust in science? In recent decades, the digital age and disciplinary diversification have sparked an explosion in the number of scientific papers being published, the number of journals in existence, and the influence of for-profit publishing. This has opened the doors for exploitation. Opportunistic paper mills sell quick publication with minimal review to academics desperate for credentials, while publishers generate substantial profits through huge article processing fees. Corporations have also seized the opportunity to fund low-quality research and ghostwrite papers intended to distort the weight of evidence, influence public policy, and alter public opinion in favour of their products. These ongoing challenges highlight the insufficiency of peer review as the primary guardian of scientific reliability. In response, efforts have sprung up to bolster the integrity of the scientific enterprise. Retraction Watch actively tracks withdrawn papers and other academic misconduct. Academic sleuths and initiatives such as Data Collada identify manipulated data and figures. Investigative journalists expose corporate influence. A new field of meta-science, science of science, attempts to measure the processes of science and to uncover biases and flaws. Not all bad science has a major impact, but some certainly does. It doesn't just stay within academia, it often seeps into public understanding and policy. In a recent investigation, we examined a widely cited safety review of the herbicide glyphosate, which appeared to be independent and comprehensive. In reality, documents produced during legal proceedings against Monsanto revealed that the paper has been ghostwritten by Monsanto employees and published in a journal with ties to the tobacco industry. After this was exposed, the paper continued to shape citations, policy documents, and Wikipedia pages worldwide. When problems like this are uncovered, they can make their way into public conversations, where they are not necessarily perceived as triumphant acts of self-correction. Rather, they may be taken as proof that something is rotten in the state of science. This science is broken narrative undermines public trust. Until recently, technological assistance in self-correction was mostly limited to plagiarism detectors. But things are changing. Machine learning services such as ImageTwin and Proofig now scan millions of figures for signs of duplication, manipulation, and AI generation. Natural language processing tools flag tortured phrases, the telltale word salads of paper mills. Bibliometric dashboards, such as the one by Semantic Scholar, trace whether papers are cited in support or contradiction. AI, especially agentic, reasoning-capable models increasingly proficient in mathematics and logic, will soon uncover more subtle flaws. For example, the Black Spatula project explores the ability of the latest AI models to check published mathematical proofs at scale, automatically identifying algebraic inconsistencies that eluded human reviewers. Our own work mentioned above also substantially relies on the large language models to process large volumes of text. Given full text access and sufficient computing power, these systems could soon enable a global audit of the scholarly record. A comprehensive audit will likely find some outright fraud and a much larger mass of routine, journeyman work with garden variety errors. These ongoing challenges highlight the insufficiency of peer review as the primary guardian of scientific reliability. In response, efforts have sprung up to bolster the integrity of the scientific enterprise. We do not know yet how prevalent fraud is, but what we do know is that an awful lot of scientific work is inconsequential. Scientists know this. It's much discussed that a good deal of published work is never or very rarely cited. To outsiders, this revelation may be as jarring as uncovering fraud because it collides with the image of dramatic, heroic scientific discovery that populates university press releases and trade press treatments. What might give this audit added weight is its AI author, which may be seen as, and may in fact be, impartial and competent, and therefore reliable. As a result, these findings will be vulnerable to exploitation in disinformation campaigns, particularly since AI is already being used to that end. Safeguarding public trust requires redefining the scientist's role in more transparent, realistic terms. Much of today's research is incremental, career-sustaining work rooted in education, mentorship, and public engagement. If we are to be honest with ourselves and with the public, we must abandon the incentives that pressure universities and scientific publishers, as well as the scientists themselves, to exaggerate the significance of their work. Truly groundbreaking work is rare, but that does not render the rest of scientific work useless. A more humble and honest portrayal of the scientist as a contributor to a collective, evolving understanding will be more robust to AI-driven scrutiny than the myth of science as a parade of individual breakthroughs. A sweeping cross-disciplinary audit is on the horizon. It could come from a government watchdog, a think tank, an anti-science group, or a corporation seeking to undermine public trust in science. Scientists can already anticipate what it will reveal. If the scientific community prepares for the findings, or better still, takes the lead, the audit could inspire a disciplined renewal. But if we delay, the cracks it uncovers may be misinterpreted as fractures in the scientific enterprise itself. Science has never derived its strength from infallibility. Its credibility lies in the willingness to correct and repair. We must now demonstrate that willingness publicly before the trust is broken. Back over to you, Jean.
Well, thank you so much, Sorrel and Dale, but let's have a bit of a break, shall we?
You're listening to 3CR Community Radio, 855 AM. Visit the 3CR website at 3cr.org.au/podcast to hear the most recent recording from each show, or 3cr.org.au/streaming to listen live.
We hope you're still listening to the Dogs program, because now there's a lot of very interesting material. Jeff, our roving scholar, has some news from the USA. Over to you, Jeff.
Good afternoon, listeners. Today we're going to do a longer article by Jeff Bryant, who's a freelance consultant and public education policy advocate, publishes in many, many different formats. This article appeared on the 31st of July 2025, and it was originally published in the Our Schools website, which is an American public education advocacy network. And the article is entitled, How the Trump Administration Wields the Federal Government's Power Over Public Education. And it begins, with the help of the US Supreme Court and congressional Republicans, Trump is turning public education into the great unequalizer. The US Supreme Court's July 14 decision to allow President Donald Trump and his Secretary of Education, Linda McMahon, to proceed with dismantling of the US Department of Education came with no explanation from the conservative majority that issued the ruling. It didn't need to. Indeed, if the court's conservative majority had provided an explanation, that would likely have been in the kind of rhetorical sleight of hand that Justice Elena Kagan described in her dissent to the court's Free Speech Coalition, Inc. versus Paxton ruling, which radically shifted the legal precedent for free speech rules. In her dissent to that ruling, Kagan argued that the conservative majority's explanations for its decisions were not based on legal precedent nor the US Constitution, but on these special for the occasion difficult to decipher rules needed to get to what it considers the right result. And that's a quote. And the right result regarding the fate of the Department of Education appears to be whatever the Trump and conservative majority want. In this case, it was meanwhile decided using the shadow docket, usually reserved for emergency cases, but more and more used to quietly rule on controversial issues with brief, often in unsigned opinions, according to the newsletter by Michael Waldman, President and CEO of Brennan Center for Justice. The court's ruling came on the heels of the Trump administration's announcement to withhold nearly $6.8 billion in funding that was to be distributed to schools and districts across the country. The money allocated by Congress was supposed to be distributed to states on 1st of July 2025. It was, by and large, funding that schools and districts were counting on to pay for programs and personnel, some of which, according to Education Week, are required by law. Many schools felt hard-pressed to find alternative sources of funding or cut services and lay off staff. 24 states sued Trump over this illegal action. The withheld money includes about 14% of all federal funding for elementary and secondary education across the country. It helps pay for free or low-cost after-school programs that give students a place to go while their parents work, according to a July 2025 New York Times article. That Trump administration edict was also issued with little explanation, according to the New York Times, with only some vague reassurance about being committed to ensuring taxpayer resources are spent in accordance with the president's priorities. The Trump administration, however, later announced that it was reversing its decision to withhold this amount after receiving a letter from 10 Republican senators imploring it to release the funds. But the president's proposed budget for 2026 eliminated all the grants that had been frozen, NPR reported. Compounding the harm inflicted on public schools, Trump and his obsequious conservative majority in the Congress also pushed through the One Big Beautiful Bill that will require staffing cuts and additional costs from public school budgets. The administration has also enacted the nation's first federal school voucher program that redirects public tax dollars to private schools. Harmful risks for students and families. Trump and his conservative allies justify these harms to public schools by insisting that the K-12 institutions, attended by 83% of students in 2021 to 2022, are woke indoctrination camps and that all decisions about school spending and operations should be returned to states. But the federal government has never had the power to set school curriculum, woke or otherwise, and state governments already have primary authority over public education. Where the federal government does have some influence in education is in its power to conduct research, fund special programs, and ensure through civil rights enforcement that students and families have access to education services. In allowing the Trump administration to dismantle the Department of Education, the Supreme Court's conservative majority is giving the go-ahead to abdicate these responsibilities. The non-profit education news site, The 74, which, as I've previously said, refers to the 74 million Americans underneath the age of 18, The 74 reported that in the initial round of employee firings and voluntary departures, the hardest hit offices included the Office for Civil Rights, which enforces civil rights laws in schools, the Institute for Education Sciences, which conducts research and collects and analyses education statistics, the National Center for Education Statistics, which administers the National Assessment for Education Progress, NAEP, and the so-called Nation's Report Card, and Federal Student Aid, which helps students pay for college. A disempowered Department of Education will create harmful risks for students and families, according to a February 2025 analysis by the think tank Century Foundation. Millions of Americans rely on federal support from the Department of Education to open doors along their educational journeys. These millions of Americans include students with disabilities whose access to education services is protected by the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, low-income students whose schools receive extra federal funding through the department's Title I program, and students and families who've requested federal government intervention because they've faced discriminatory treatment in schools due to their national origin, immigration status, sexual identity, disability, race, or religion. The Trump administration is widely expected to turn civil rights enforcement on its head in ways that harm historically marginalised communities, the Century Foundation analysis stated. Trump's other education policies will have equally harmful impacts on the most vulnerable students and families. The decision to withhold congressionally allotted funds to schools specifically targeted federal grant programs that serve high-needs populations, such as migrant students, English learners, students who need access to academic enrichment programs, and after-school and summer learning programs, according to an analysis by New America, a Washington, D.C.-based think tank. The impact of the withheld funds would have been much greater on students and families in certain school districts, particularly high-needs districts, New America said. Nationwide, students from low-income backgrounds would have been especially at risk of losing education resources, according to New America. Districts serving high-poverty student populations, those where over 25% of students live in poverty, would have lost over five times as much funding per pupil as low-poverty school districts. The sprawling budget reconciliation bill that Trump and Republicans passed with its cuts to Medicaid and food assistance programs will also add to the cost of schools' student health services and free meals programs, which are essential to low-income communities. The false narrative. The fact that these attacks on the public education system are being made during a time when conservative Republicans control the White House, Congress, and the Supreme Court, with little to no explanation, should surprise no one. Anyone who's been paying attention has long known that the primary role conservative Republicans feel the federal government has in public education is punitive and controlling. They have rarely done anything to support schools and educators and address the needs and interests of students. This has been clear ever since the former President Ronald Reagan called for abolishing the Department of Education and then used the department's resources and clout to form a commission that issued a scathing report, A Nation at Risk, now widely discredited, which education historian Diana Ravitch has said launched the false narrative that American public schools were failing. Conservatives continued in their campaign to use federal agencies to punish public education when William Bennett, Reagan's Secretary of Education in his second term, weaponized the NAEP. According to education psychologist David Berliner and James Harvey, an author of A Nation at Risk, who became a prominent critic of it, Bennett changed the standardized test's intent from its original purpose of measuring what students at various grade levels actually know to a new goal, judging what students at various grade levels should know, and created a proficiency benchmark that the vast majority of students in most nations cannot clear. Conservative Republicans drew a straight line from changing the purpose of the NAEP to enacting, with the complicity of most Democrats, No Child Left Behind, NCLB, during the presidency of George W. Bush. NCLB, No Child Left Behind, set in motion a policy agenda largely still intact to today. This includes using test score data like the NAEP to label public schools as failures and closing them down or privatising them. Although cutting funds to the NAEP would appear to undercut its weaponisation, the Trump administration has vowed to continue administering the tests. Trump's first presidential term continued to weaponise federal involvement in education with the hiring of Betsy DeVos as his Secretary of Education. DeVos was openly hostile to the mission of public education, and she loudly advocated for redirecting government funds from public education to private schools. Inequality is the point. Democrats, for their part, are currently voicing their opposition to these cuts. Even before the Supreme Court cleared the way for Trump to dismantle the public Department of Education, 11 Democratic senators in March 2025 called for an investigation into the massive layoffs and spending cuts McMahon carried out. The injunction that temporarily blocked the cuts, which the Supreme Court overruled, was brought by New York and 20 other Democratic-led states, two Massachusetts school districts, and the American Federation of Teachers, Education Week reported. More than 175 Democratic members of Congress, according to ABC News, filed an amicus brief supporting a lawsuit brought by the National Association for the Advancement of Coloured People to block the dismantling of the department. But all of that was before the court's ruling. In response to the withholding of billions of federal funds, more than 100 Democratic House representatives sent a letter to McMahon and the Director of the Office of Management and Budget, Russell Voigt, and asking why the funds were being withheld in July. In a separate letter, 32 Democratic senators demanded an immediate end to the illegal withholding. But for the Trump administration and a majority of conservative Republicans serving in Congress and on the nation's highest court, the only constituents that seem to matter are white, wealthy ones. And the nation's system of public education should be bent to ensure they get what they want out of it first. Yes, that's a damning summary of some of the things that have been going on in the states in the education. I heard a joke the other day, which was, we hope that that Trump does get his big, beautiful bill, but that's the name of the guy who shares a cell with him. Anyway, with that, I'm going to send you back to the headquarters of the Dogs and give you something to thank the lucky stars about the fact that we don't have the Trump administration or anything like it in Australia yet. And let's hope that continues. Anyway, with that, folks, I'm going to pass you back. Cheerio, have a nice weekend.
Well, thanks, Jeff. That material from Jeff Bryant was interesting, of course, and a bit scary. But now we come to the best part of our program, the good news story. The teachers up there in New South Wales have been fighting to get counsellors in the school. Down here and in other parts of Australia, of course, we've got not school counsellors, but of all things, chaplains. But they want qualified school counsellors the way they used to have years ago up in New South Wales, and they're getting them. Let's hear about it, shall we?
Thanks, Jean. Updated program seeks to increase qualified school counsellor numbers. And this is from the New South Wales Teachers Federation and published on the 24th of July. The Department of Education has launched an updated School Counsellor in Training program, which supports teachers in their fourth and fifth years of their psychology studies to complete their qualification and join the school counselling service. The union has a long-standing position that school counsellors hold dual qualifications in teaching and psychology. Teachers know that a dual qualification is a vital requirement for school counsellors to support student needs and improve both individual learning and life outcomes. The 2021 Gallup Inquiry report into the value of teachers' work recommended that, as a matter of priority, the department must provide school counsellors at a ratio of at least one counsellor for every 500 students. Before the 2023 state election, New South Wales Labor promised $75 million to recruit an additional 250 full-time equivalent FTE school counsellors in their first term of government. On commitment, Labor described it as the first step towards reaching a ratio of one counsellor for every 500 students. Back to you, Jean.
And now we come to the very best program, our great partner program, our great state school.
Every week on the Doctor Program, we have a special segment to show a different state school is a great school.
State schools are great schools.
School of the week. State school.
School of the week.
Great state schools.
State schools. School of the week. School for the week here on the Dogs Program.
And this week's great state school of the week is Mortlake College. And Mortlake is a small town about 40 minutes drive north of Warrnambool in Western Victoria. A message from the principal. As a P-12 school, we believe a great strength is our ability to provide a seamless transition between primary and secondary schooling, as we have an extensive knowledge of every student's learning and social needs. There are many things that I believe make our school an inclusive and vibrant learning community. This is made up of the broad selection of programs and learning opportunities for our students to engage in. Our school has a focus on continuous improvement in every aspect of school life. We aim to maximise each student's potential so that all will experience success. Our school goals focus on improving our students' levels of achievement in all domains of the curriculum. Our school has three distinct learning teams to develop and deliver curriculum at the different stages of learning and acknowledging age-appropriate needs. The physical layout of the school reflects the sub-school groupings with areas for P-6 and 7-12. We operate a vertical curriculum for years 7-12, which broadens the range of subject choices for students and provides a structure for students to work at a level more suited to their needs. Our house system is an important aspect of school life, with all students aligned to one of the houses. The house names reflect the school's philosophy: inspire, endeavour, succeed. Our school program provides students with the opportunity to excel in a range of enrichment programs: performing arts, which includes production and festival performances, public speaking, instrumental music, sporting teams, and camps and excursions at all year levels, including tours of New Zealand. We combine the best of a traditional approach to teaching with innovative and exciting programs at all levels. Schools are dynamic places, and good relationships underpin the foundations of our school. Every day, I genuinely walk into our school with a real sense of optimism and enthusiasm. I just love the energy that exists in a school environment. There is a strong partnership between parents and staff, with a high level of participation in classroom programs such as classroom helpers, and also in broad school activities and programs such as the school productions. We have an active parents association who support the school in many ways, including through fundraising activities. Mortlake College is proud of its achievements in student learning. We have a strong focus on literacy and numeracy at all levels, and we support students with strong literacy and numeracy intervention programs. Individual learning plans strengthen our results by addressing the needs of individual students. One of the great strengths of our school has been our excellent VCE results over a long period of time. In 2020 and 2021, our school was listed in the top 10 VCE performers in regional Victoria. The VCAL certificate was also introduced in 2020 to broaden our pathway options to students. Our staff is committed to giving students the best possible chances to maximise their results through smaller class sizes and knowledge of individual student learning. In the Attitudes to School survey, our student responses are above the state average. This indicates that students at both the primary and secondary level have a strong sense of belonging and an enjoyment of school. Positive education and respectful relationship principles are designed to provide students with an understanding of what factors assist in creating a sense of well-being. We use the restorative practices model of behaviour management. Each student is aware that they will be held accountable for their behaviour and will be dealt with fairly and consistently. Mortlake P-12 College has a real sense of community because it is filled with people who care and want to see success. We look forward to achieving success together. And that's a message from Linda Musik, the principal of Mortlake P-12 College. Now, the enrolment is 187 and the ICSEA value is below average at 967. So this is representative of a regional rural community. The upper 25% of parental incomes make up 7% of students. 19% of students have parents in the second quartile of parental incomes. And in the third quartile, i.e. below average income, is 30% of students. And in the bottom 25% of parental incomes, 45% of students, with 6% speaking a language other than English and 6% Indigenous students. And the finances, recurrent grants from the Australian government, $1.126 million, and from the Victorian government, $4.048 million. Fees and parental contributions add $122,000, and there's another $107,000 from private contributions. And that works out at $28,986 per pupil. The capital, $259,000 over 3 years. All students in Year 12 received their certificate in 2024 and the NAPLAN results are just fine. Back to you, Jean.
Congratulations to Mortlake College. What a lovely place it must be. And our time has gone, so it's up to me to tell you that if you want to hear about more of us, you can go to the 3CR website and look at our podcasts, or you can go to our website at www.adogs.info. But our time is gone, and it's up to me to thank our wonderful producer, Dale, and also Sorrel, of course, and Jeff and Andy, who does such a wonderful job every week. But from all of us here at 3CR, it's bye for now.
Saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. In Salt Lake City, Joe says I, him standing by my bed. They framed you on a murder charge, says Joe, but I'm dead. Says Joe, but I'm dead. The copper bosses killed you, Joe. They shot you, Joe, says I. Takes more than guns to kill a man, says Joe, I didn't die, says Joe, I didn't die. And standing there as big as life and smiling with his eyes, says Joe, what they can never kill, went on to organize, went on to organize. From San Diego up to Maine, in every mine and mill, where workers strike and organize, it's there you'll find your hill. It's there you'll find. I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.